Accession number 12175, row 5.
Lieutenant Commander Big Weather Reel 5. What about the casualties on those attacks on the Sakishima Gunter?
Yes, on the first attack on May the 4th, which came really completely without warning, and as I said, the deck park was being brought forward, so all the aircraft handlers were on deck. I think there were about 11 killed and something like almost 50 men wounded. One of the pilots, or one or two of the pilots taxiing forward, were also killed or very badly wounded. I think one of them died badly wounded and died later. And then on the second one, on May the 9th, we had good warning, and only one man was killed. I think he was on the pom-poms or something like that. So it was much, not so much damage was done. But it landed more or less in the same spot as the first one. Very odd. If any of the Japs had known and come into the side of the ship instead of onto the deck, they would have done far more damage.
Because of the lack of armour?
Yes, yes.
I think that you went back to Sydney after those attacks.
Yes, after those attacks, then something else happened. We were due to do two more days' operations. And when we were in the refueling area, one of the air gunners in my squadron, unfortunately, pressed the firing button in the hangar, and the guns went off straight into an Avenger in front of it, which caught fire. And there was an enormous hangar fire. Scuppers were all full of rags and so forth, and the water wasn't running away. The whole hangar was sprinkled, of course, and most of the aircraft had the cockpit covers open, so the salt water was coming down amongst all the instruments and so forth, and it really they got the fire out in about an hour or two. But the ship, not before the ship heeled over quite a bit. And I was, in fact, on the quarter deck at the time. I had my Mae West on. I couldn't get back into the ship at all because it was absolutely, it was red hot. And so I remained on the quarter deck until it was safe to get back into the ship. Anyhow, we replaced most of those aircraft. We said we would fly the ones which had been sprinkled with salt water. We would use them for combat air patrol over the fleet, but not over the islands, because we thought it was too risky to send people with aircraft which might... the engine might stop or something. On a mission, that we would keep them over the fleet. If something happened, they would be able to bail out, or at least the pilot would be saved. And then we also took some replacement aircraft on board at the same time, so we had a few operational aircraft, and we were able to do this 2 days. And then Formidable was sent back to Sydney ahead of the rest of the fleet, because we were really the most severely damaged of the lot. The problem was with this fire in the hangar that the kamikazes had prevented us putting the hangar doors. There were two doors there to prevent fires going right through the ship, and those couldn't be lowered because the kamikazes put them out of action. So the damage was much worse because of that. So then we went back to Sydney and we re-equipped with new Corsair 4s, which were the engines started electrically instead of with cartridge starters. And we always found the cartridge starter very difficult because to get the mixture absolutely right. And if the cartridge didn't work, then another cartridge had to be selected and so on. Whereas the electric starters, much easier to start up, no problem. And then the squadrons all went ashore of Sydney and had some leave. And then we went on board again for the final operation against Japan mainland, with the same fleet, 4 aircraft carriers and 3 backup carriers, which carried replacement pilots, replacement aircraft, and drop tanks, etc. And this is what I want to say about the drop tanks on Corsairs, which increased our endurance from the normal 3 hours to about 4.5 hours, even 5 they could do. And our policy was to land on with them providing we hadn't been into aerial combat, because of course it cut down the speed enormously. So if we had to do chasing a Japanese aircraft or something, we dropped that tank so if we could get the extra speed. But if we were strafing airfields, which we were doing mainly in Japan, we were asked to bring them back on board the ship because we were very short of supplies. Well, on about the fourth or fifth day of operations, we were strafing an airfield in the Tokyo plain, and I saw one of my flight, after doing the strafing run, just on my left, with his tank on fire. So I shouted out to him to drop it, but he either didn't hear, or I don't know, and it just blew up. And of course he went straight into the... And after that, I said to the ship's officers, I said, I think we really can't risk this again. We've got to drop our tanks. We use them up, get into the target, drop them, and then get rid of them before we went in for an attack. So we did that in future. And thank goodness... the final attacks on Japan, I think, were only from July the 17th to August the 10th, as far as Formidable was concerned. And due to bad weather, we only did about 8 days operating over that period.
And you say it was the Tokyo plan?
Hmm?
You say it was the Tokyo plain area?
Well, we started off in northern Honshu on the first 2 days, then we went Tokyo plain on the second, inland sea on 2 days on the third, Then we went right over to the west coast, to a place called Maizuru. On one of those days, I shot down what we think was a Kate, but nobody quite knows what he was doing there. I don't think it saw us coming. It certainly wasn't attacking us or anything, but it was just flying along. So I was so surprised, and I, bringing all my training at that RAF fighter course, and I did what I thought was the perfect quarter attack on it, and I pressed the firing button, and to my utter surprise, the thing just blew up, and I was absolutely mesmerized by it, and practically flew through the debris. Suddenly realized that I'd hit the busy thing.
That was off the west coast of Honshu?
That was the west coast, Maizuru, which was really opposite the inland sea, the other side of Japan from the inland sea. Mm. But on the very first day we were up there, it was on July the 17th. The captain asked me, I was a senior CO, and he asked me if the other squadron could do the first strike in order to have the benefit of the element of surprise. And so I naturally complied, although I was rather annoyed about it. Anyhow, they took off at about 6 in the morning, and in terrible weather. 16 Corsairs. The Avengers, the weather was too bad for them to take off, so it was really fighter strikes. And they managed to get in underneath the cloud to attack these two airfields, which were right on the coast. This was northern Honshu. And they did quite a lot of damage there. And by the time I took off, a lot of them were hit too. I think one was shot down, and a lot of them came back with damage, flak damage. And by the time I took off at 8 o'clock, the weather was even worse. And so I went under cloud as far as I could. I didn't know what kind of reception I was going to get, and they got a very hot reception. And because I didn't hear what they'd done. Anyhow, we got in to about, I suppose, 5 miles off the coast by my reckoning, and we reached down. The fog was absolutely right down, and I thought it was no good, we're going to hit the coast and we'll all be written off. And so I decided to go to our secondary target, which was on the east coast of west coast rather of Japan. So we went up through this cloud, all 12 of us in formation, close formation, and got to 10,000 feet, and we were still in cloud. And one of my boys then called up and said that his oxygen wasn't working, so I couldn't go any higher, so we had to stay in cloud until we came out eventually about 10 miles from our target on the west coast, and the weather suddenly cleared up and we were in sunshine. I looked around, much to my surprise everybody was there, and we found our target was absolutely dead ahead, an airfield there. And so we had a great time attacking aircraft on the ground. I think we counted about 9 flamers on the ground, so they weren't dummies. And we didn't notice any anti-aircraft things. So we did the unforgivable and did another run on it. And again, nobody was was hit, and we did some more damage. Then we found, on our way home, we found a train just about going into a tunnel, so we fired at the engine of that, and a lot of steam came up. Then we went back into the cloud again and back to the ship.
When did you say that was?
That was on the first day of operations against Japan, on the 17th of July. And it was rather odd later. There was a prisoner of war camp, apparently, which we didn't know about, very near this airfield. And when we got back after Sydney, at the end of the war, I was in Sydney for about 6 weeks before I came home, I met a chap who had been a prisoner of war there in the Union Club in Sydney. And he said he'd seen us coming in, and the whole camp was cheering. But he said, didn't notice anybody firing at you. Oh, he said, didn't you? He said, there were small arms going up at you all over the place. I said, well, we never saw it, and nobody got hit, so they must have been very bad shots. So that was rather interesting.
Any other incidents that stick out in your mind from those attacks on mainland Japan?
Well, it was the same story, really. We did half the time doing combat air patrols over the fleet or over the picket ships. There were always four destroyers well inland. And so that when you came out after an attack, you went to those destroyers, not direct to the fleet. The idea being that if you went straight back to the fleet, the Japs would track you where the main force was. And so we always went to these picket destroyers. And then from there, we went back to the fleet. That was the object of the thing. Another thing we had for that trip, I remember, was a machine which the Americans had given us to fill a drop tank with napalm so that we could drop this into caves and places where we couldn't get into. And I was asked to test this thing out. And so this machine would have churned out this stuff and put it in the drop tank and put on my aircraft. The captain said, this was in one of the rest days, he said, well, I want you to drop it just about sort of 100 yards alongside the ship, and just want to see what kind of area this enormous flaming device is going to cover. And so I went up and I flew sort of rather slowly alongside the ship and pulled the lever to drop the tank and expected to feel it go. It didn't go. I pulled it again and again and again. Didn't go. So I pulled up very gently, and after I'd gone about half a mile, I suppose, I suddenly felt it drop off. And I was just about over the destroyer screen at that time, and I was fearful that this blessed thing was going to drop right on one of these destroyers. Unfortunately, it didn't. But it went. It certainly did its job. It went off with a terrific sort of flames all everywhere. When I got back to ship, I said to the captain, I don't think this is on, because these drop tanks are so unreliable that sometimes they come off, sometimes they don't. And if they get hit by flak, of course, that's carrying this stuff on board, that's the end of the pilot straight away.
That was the first time you've seen the palm.
Yes. We didn't use it after that, glad to say. But there was two or three occasions where people coming back with drop tanks, they tried to drop it, the tank hadn't come off. But when they caught an arrestor wire, the force of catching that sent the drop tank forward either hit the prop or something like that, and usually caught fire. By that time, they should have been empty. And they were a bit of a curse, those drop tanks. We weren't very pleased with them at all. They weren't self-sealing, of course. So, I mean, any bullet in them would make a hole, maybe catch a thing on fire. But over the Japan, they did use tracer quite a lot, and so we could see the gun positions much more clearly than we had done at Sakishima.
Can you tell me something about what it was like in Sydney at that stage of the war?
Oh, it was absolutely marvellous. The Australians were tremendously hospitable. And we had a great time. Everybody, the whole ship's company, had invitations out to families, and they were really absolutely marvellous. Can't speak highly enough of them. They were marvellous stuff.
Did you ever come across conflicts between the British and the American servicemen in Sydney?
Well, the Americans, most of them had left by then. They had been in Sydney, of course, before us, and most of them had left. But we had a wonderful naval liaison officer on board us, Commander Hedges, who used to do all the broadcasts to the ship's company at the end of the day. He used to say what the ramrods, as we call them, the fighter attacks, had achieved, and what the bombers had achieved, and generally give commentary to the ship's company and what their ship had been doing that day. And he always made it amusing as well. We were very fond of him.
Did you ever hear any Lord Haw-Haw type broadcasts from Japan whilst you were in the forest?
No, I didn't. No.
Because the Americans had this Tokyo Rose lady broadcast.
Yes, we didn't. Not that I know of, anyway.
What was your reaction when you heard about the dropping of the atomic bombs?
Well, we heard about that the following day, I think it was, the following morning, August the 7th. And we were, at that time, we were in the refueling area. And we were to start attacking again on the 8th, I think it was. And I must say, I wondered why we were being asked to continue attacking after this enormous bomb had been dropped, and it seemed pretty clear to everybody that the Japs couldn't withstand that for very long. So I was most surprised, really, when we did those last 2 days' operations, and in a way I rather resented it, because in those 2 days, I not only lost my senior pilot, Hammy Gray, but two other pilots, one Canadian and one British. In fact, the chap who wrote that diary was killed then. And I just thought it was unnecessary to go on. But however, we did the 2 days on August the 9th, when Hammy Gray was killed, attacking and sinking a destroyer, and again on the 10th. And, I had a good friend on the staff. Vine was flying his flag in Formidable then, and I had a good friend then. I asked him about it. I said, "Do you think we ought to be again risking people's lives after this has happened?" And he said, well, the Americans want us to do it, so we've got to do it. But he said, and we were given instructions by the captain to take it easy and not to do anything dangerous in these last days, to strafe from a greater height and so forth. But my dear friend Hemi Gray saw these destroyers and destroyer escorts in this little harbour when he was going, in fact, to his orders were to attack the airfields. Because all through the second period, this final period in Japan, the Japs didn't come up against us at all. No suiciders. We had one or two snoopers, as we call them, finding out where we were, but we were never attacked. And so all our operations were aggressive, attacking the airfields and shipping and so forth in Japan.
Was he the chap who you said specialised in attacking destroyers?
That's right.
Why did he specialise in doing that?
He disliked them.
Any reason?
No, for no particular reason. He thought they were a good target. He happened to see these on his way in. And when he got to the airfield, I'd already been off with my attacking force that day, and we'd done quite a bit of damage at the airfield. And he got there, and he couldn't find anything worth attacking. And so he decided to go back and get these destroyers. And on his first run, he was hit, and we don't know whether he was hit himself or not, but he flew right over the destroyer and dropped his bomb very low level, skipped it into the side of the vessel, and flew over the ship, and then turned right over and went straight in.
Which would you say was your worst time during the war?
I think definitely the Pacific, because it was a day after day after day job, and I think also being CEO of the squadron, I had a lot of work to do after I'd done my flying, and on the rest days I had all the paperwork to do, and the organization of the refuelings, you know, all kinds of things which the other pilots didn't have to do.
Could you have taken time off from flying in order to cope with the administration?
No, because we didn't have enough pilots. We were using every pilot, and certainly the flight leaders, like myself, had to fly on every single operation.
Would you have preferred to have taken time off from the flying to have coped with the administration?
It did cross my mind on occasion that I'd like to do that. But somehow or other, I don't know how it is, but one always feels that one's going to survive. And I must say I was... the anticipation of going on a strike was certainly worse than actually doing it. Directly got in the air, it really didn't have any... The fear went, which was a very good thing. I had too much to do.